Happy to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest today, Bassam Shakashiri. Back again, he's a UW-Madison professor of chemistry and the William T. Evue Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin Idea. Really happy to have him along today to talk with us about science and science research. And certainly you may have some questions as we move along today, and you're welcome to join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison, reach us at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Join on in. Join the fun. Bassam, welcome back. Nice to have you with us again.
Nice to be with you again, Larry.
There's been a call for a presidential debate on science and technology, candidates debate. And I think there's a concerned citizens initiative, and people are wondering whether the U.S. presidential candidates would be willing to share their views on this.
I think this is a very good idea. As you know, Larry, science and technology are the engines that drive our economy. They not only drive our economy, but they have serious consequences in all aspects of our daily lives and our society, in communications, in healthcare, environmental issues, transportation, you name it. Science and technology are the basis for what goes on. And that's why I think it is a very good idea for the presidential candidates to have such a debate. Scientific organizations, including the National Academy of Sciences, have called for such a debate. And let's be clear about this. It's not a debate about the content of science. It's about the application and uses of science and technology. So the candidates will not be asked questions about intrinsic details in chemical transformations or medicine or anything like that. This is not a debate among scientists. This is a debate that will call attention to the real significance of science and technology in our lives. And we cannot just ignore this. I mean, there's so many science and technology themes, including health, energy, the environment, homeland security, education, innovation, competitiveness. So I think there's a whole slew of issues that can be brought to the forefront by the presidential candidates, which will help us understand where they stand, where they might take us if elected, but also equally important, will bring the level of discussion to a wider audience. And so, you know, in that regard, I just wonder if we can ask our listening audience to call in with some questions that they would like to ask a presidential candidate as far as issues that relate to science and technology. I have a list of them. It's not an all-exhaustive list, but, you know, I'm not the only one who has such interest. As I say, there are scientific educational organizations that are promoting this. There are websites going up with suggested questions. So I think this is an important part, and it will be the first time that it has happened in a presidential election. We've seen a lot of first things in a presidential election recently, so this will be a good thing.
And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, excuse me, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And if you have a question that you think the candidates should answer, or if you just have another question you'd like to bring up, please feel free to do that as we move along here and talk with Bassam. Well, give us one off your list, maybe. Can you give us one off your list?
Oh, yes, sir. I'll give you a couple, if that's okay.
Sure.
What do you think the appointees to the cabinet and to other high offices in the government should be subjected to as far as screening? Should there be an acid litmus test of some sort about issues that relate to stem cell research, or about issues that relate to carbon tax, about issues that relate to mercury emissions and mercury controls? What about safety in mines? What about issues that have to do with FDA regulations? A whole slew of issues. What about genetically modified foods? What should the regulations be, and how should we reach an informed decision as to what these regulations should be?
Well, good questions. John in La Crosse has a question or comment. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, just a couple of things. One is, I know it's not really important like the environment or anything, but monopolies as far as technology goes, like the fact that Microsoft now with Vista is controlling, I don't know if you know a lot about cable cards and the FCC ruling about everything going with the digital broadcasting.
Yeah.
Well, now I guess it's Microsoft is Vista building in firmware, and only certain companies like Dell and Gateway are being able to build computers that will be for sale that will allow you to run your cable through it. And
so you're
Go ahead.
You know, so you're looking at this whole issue of a few companies maybe controlling people's access to science or science information in a way.
That's a very good issue, I think, to address. What is the federal role in regulating technology transfer to society? So new innovations, new advances, new applications are, you know, brought to the market. What should the federal government do about that? And so whether it's in commerce or in health or in transportation, these are very, very important questions that should be addressed. And I think John is right on in raising this kind of question that presidential candidates and, frankly, Larry, all other elected officials should be thinking about and should be helping us also focus on and try to address.
Yeah, it's a good one, John. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. Eric and Kohler, it's your turn. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Hey, I have a chemistry question. Is anybody working on processes to directly take carbon out of the atmosphere? I would love to have a little still that I could set up with a solar panel to somehow take carbon, separate carbon from carbon dioxide, and then sell that carbon for industrial processes or something like that.
There are people who do research on carbon sequestration, removing carbon dioxide from the environment, and then converting it to other fuels and other products. Yes, there are people who do research in these areas. And actually, I can post on my website a couple of links for Eric and others who might be interested in this. This is an important question that we have to look into. But we also we should be aware that the economics of what's going on here is important. So sometimes it costs you more energy to recover something than you can get out of it. So, but this again relates to the removal of carbon from carbon dioxide specifically from the environment, and that will help greatly in reducing global warming.
Is that a hard process to separate the carbon from the oxygen?
Well, you know, actually carbon and oxygen are bonded together very strongly in carbon dioxide. So it's not very easy to break those strong bonds, but there are ways to do it. And that's what I say. It's the consideration is, you know, is it economically feasible to do it on the scale that it would have to be done? And so right now it is a laboratory a situation where people are trying to do some experiments and propose models for removing a lot of carbon dioxide from the environment and breaking it down, as you say, into carbon. And then, you know, what do you do with the carbon? You burn it again, you're going to get more carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
So you know, we really have to think this through very carefully and be deliberate about what it is that we are attempting to do. And just because, if it turns out that we can do it, just because we can do something, we have to ask ourselves, is it wise to do it?
Yeah.
Not only is it economically feasible, but is it wise to do it for all kinds of considerations?
And you should, and your website, by the way, is www.scifun.org, and it's just scifun.org. So, Eric, take a look. I'm sure it won't be up in the next hour. But
no, in the next couple of days.
Next couple of days.
We always put a summary of the conversations I have with you and with our listening audience, Larry. And I get a lot of questions as a result of this, and I'm happy to answer them. Happy to have people visit our website. We have a lot of interesting things on the website, including experiments you can do at home and so on. And we answer those questions usually quickly. The only type of question we don't answer is homework problems. Students have to do their own homework. We don't answer homework problems.
Okay. Eric, thanks.
Call again.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Yeah, you know, Tim Donahue and the folks at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center might be doing some work in that area. That would be one possible spot.
That's one of the websites I will put a link to.
Yeah. All right. Give us a call or email us, too, at talk@wpr.org. The National Science Board publishes a list of science and engineering indicators, 2008. What does this broad base of quantitative information say about the U.S. and international science and engineering?
This is a very useful document that is required by law. The National Science Board is the governing board of the National Science Foundation, the federal agency that provides support for research in science and in education. And by law, such a report has to be presented to the president and to the Congress every 2 years. The latest edition was published last month. It is full of excellent information about all kinds of areas that relate to scientific human resources, graduation rates in different states, the effect of science and technology, federal support on the economy, the effect of science and technology on globalization, on international affairs. There are about 8 or 9 chapters in this. It's free. Mm. It's available on the web. Again, I'll put a link.
Put a link up.
But one of the interesting chapters that I really look at very carefully is the one on the one that deals with the public attitudes and the public understanding of science. So this is a useful source of information for people who want to learn more about the significance of science and technology in our society. So, for example, in this report, in this chapter on public attitudes and understanding, it is as a result of scientific surveys, it's true that more Americans now select TV as their primary source of science and technology information than any other medium, television. This is followed closely by the internet. Now, Larry, 20 years ago when I started coming on your show here, did we talk about the internet?
We didn't.
There was no internet back then, right? So internet is a good source of science and technology information, but the internet has a lot of stuff on it. Let me put it that way. And we have to be selective and exercise judgment when we look at the internet. More Americans now learn about specific scientific issues through the internet than they did before.
And I'm betting that it'll be number one, take over television, and then you wonder down the road what will replace the internet. Fun to think about, isn't it, though?
It's not only fun. It's intriguing. It is challenging. As I say, 20 years ago, there was no internet. So these surveys are very, very, very informative to decision makers, but to the public at large. For example, the public knowledge of science hasn't changed very much over the years. The respect that the American public has for scientists and engineers and mathematicians remains very high. Mm-hmm. But the extent of understanding of some scientific issues
is pretty low.
Is not as good as it can
be. It could
be.
Yeah.
It should be better. And so this is a very useful document for everybody to look at. It's very, very helpful in recognizing that policy decisions in Washington, even in the private sector, are influenced by such findings. And so I highly recommend this, and I cite data from such reports in just about everything that I do. I just thought I'd mention to you that, and to the listening audience, that here's an example of something that requires more attention. 1 in 10 Americans consider themselves, quote, very familiar, unquote, with biotechnology. 1 out of 10, 10% of the population. Yet biotechnology has burst in the past 15, 20 years, and it's going to continue. Most Americans, about 60% of Americans, believe they have not eaten genetically modified foods. In fact, all processed foods commonly contain genetically modified ingredients.
Yeah.
So the level of awareness can be increased. And these statistics and these tallies give us a telltale about the kinds of things we should focus on if we are interested, as I am, in promoting science literacy, that is, the public understanding and appreciation of science.
Bassam Shakashiri, our guest, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking science today with Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry. Jack in Waukesha has a question or comment, so let's go to Jack. Hi, Jack. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. In the area of science and the environment, the question of paper or plastic at the grocery store has come up again.
Yeah.
And bags that are being commonly sold now at the grocery stores and at Walgreens and even at Ace Hardware that are all intended to be reusable. They all have tags in them that say 100% polypropylene. And there's this question as to whether or not that means they're cloth and biodegradable. They're solid pieces that are embossed to look like they're woven cloth, but they're not cloth and they're not woven. So what is that polypropylene biodegradable in the sense that we talk about or not?
Jack, polypropylene is a plastic. Mm-hmm. It is a polymeric substance. It is synthesized by human beings. It is one of the products of the petroleum industry. Mm-hmm. It is a product of petrochemicals, as is ethylene, you know, from which we make polyethylene, polybutadiene, the rubber, polystyrene, what we have in our coffee cups, mm-hmm. The styrofoam coffee cups. That's a trade name, but that's okay. I can use that.
Yeah.
So the question is, you know, to read the label carefully and to be clear about what it is that you're trying to do. If you're trying to be environmentally responsible, you should be thinking about the disposal of the various items that you use. That's what I do.
Yeah.
Think about, you know, how am I going to dispose of this? Is it going to end up in a landfill? Is it biodegradable? Is it a substance that will contribute to a long-time pollution problems? What is the cost of recycling it? When you put it in the recycling bin, what happens to it after that?
Yeah.
Does it really get recycled? What is the cost of recycling? So all kinds of questions about not only plastic or paper as we go through at the supermarket now, but questions that have to do with these very common products that we use that are plastics. They're very useful. They are relatively inexpensive. They're derived and made through industrial processes from chemicals that come from the petrochemical industry, hence our dependence on petrol and on oil. But so, Jack, I would say that these substances are important to know about, and it is one has to be careful in making the selection and the choices that among the choices that we are confronted with.
Yeah, and we got some bags from our local grocery store that we take back and forth with us when we go to the grocery store. I think Renee bought 5 bags. And so I think that's kind of what Jack was talking about. And even if they might be made of a plastic material, at least you're not – you're reusing and reusing and reusing the material. So.
That's what we do too, Larry. I think he asked also if polypropylene is biodegradable, and I don't think so.
No, I don't think it is. Yeah. Thanks, Jack. Matthew in Lodi, it's your turn. Hi.
Hello. Apologize for my voice. I've had a cold. My question concerns technology that – is paid for using public funds, but is done at a university. I've seen in the recent news that Wharf is suing Intel, that's Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation,
right,
over some intellectual knowledge of how microprocessors are built. They basically said that Intel used ideas that were researched at the university in one of their products, and they want to be paid royalties. And I'm wondering if that is going to have a chilling effect on advancements in knowledge being put to useful products. I understand that the university needs to patent the idea so a private company doesn't do the same thing and basically take the research, but shouldn't the technology that's paid for with public funds be available for everyone to implement?
Very good question, Matthew. I think I'd like to break it into two parts, and Matthew covered both of them. Yes, if someone comes up with a new invention, and this person is a faculty member at UW-Madison or part of the UW system, then the patent rights are shared with the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, WARF. WARF has been a great supporter of research and education for decades, and they provide funds for supporting graduate students, securing supplies, carrying out highly important scientific research. So they have to be careful about infringements on the patents, and that's, I think, what's happening with Microsoft, with Intel. I'm sorry, not. With Intel now. And this is part of the legal system that we have in our country. So, you know, if you have a patent, somebody infringes on it, then you sue them. It is an acceptable process, and it is, I think, an important process to continue to practice and practice well. The second part is we make new discoveries. Should we make, based on support provided by public funds through grants from federal agencies or state agencies? There is a raging debate now in the scientific community as to whether or not these results should be published in something called public access. Should there be public access immediately, or should they be published in a scientific journal? The National Institutes of Health, for example, are required by law to have their grantees make their results available on the web after a certain period of time, relatively short period of time. There isn't yet uniform agreement as to how this is going to play, how this should be done. And it's not clear to me how it's going to play out. But I'll tell you, I'm for open access. I think in the democratic institutions that we belong to here, we have to be open about what we do. Yes, there are people who do classified research, and that's a different issue. That's Matthew's talking about. So I think these are important questions. And this would make a very good question in the presidential candidates debate.
Oh, it would. It definitely would. Thanks, Matthew. Appreciate the call. Jim in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I got some cascading questions here, and you can pick and choose as you wish. When you had the discussion earlier of the of capturing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, is this using the platinum catalytic converter type technology? And if so, how easy is it to actually, after it's captured, use it again? And if that is possible, then what if we put it on the stacks in the first place rather than letting it into the atmosphere and then try and capture, you know, rope, herd it back together again afterwards? And then the last one would be, how long do you think it's going to take before hydrogen fuel cell will come in and pretty much replace a lot of this stuff? Because I think that that particular technology is compatible with probably 80% of our energy use. And what and how does the fuel cell compare in power generation to let's say gasoline?
Okay,
very good questions, Jim. I'm impressed by the range of coverage that you have here. So, I know I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't think anyone else does as far as the timeline for the so-called hydrogen economy. There are many outstanding researchers who are doing excellent work in this area, trying to make this not only feasible but also through technology transfer available to the public. So. So I don't know how long it's going to be, but I do know we have to be patient, we have to be persistent, we have to be vigilant in supporting those people who are doing this kind of research. And part of the question there is also the how economically viable this will be. There are also safety issues because hydrogen is a very potentially explosive gas when it combines with oxygen. It can combine in lots of different ways, but it can be dangerous. Now, the question about using a platinum catalyst, I think, was part of the earlier thing he asked about. Yes, catalysis is a highly populated field of science. There are lots of people doing research on catalysts to make a reaction go one way instead of another way, to make the reaction product that is desirable become more available economically, cheaply, and also be environmentally friendly. So there are all kinds of catalysts. I don't know specifically if platinum has been used for the sequestration of carbon dioxide, but I'll look into it between now and the time we post that those links on the website. But all kinds of metals, all kinds of metals are potential catalysts, and that's what highly specialized, focused research is all about, to find out what these catalysts are and whether or not using that process is going to be economically viable. I think that's a good question.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Jim. Appreciate your call. And John in Washburn, it's your turn next. Hi, John.
Hi. Good afternoon. My question is, I was a former employee of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and I worked mainly on the Magellan Project. And while I was there, we always thought that unprobed or unmanned spacecraft that we sent up, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory sent up, would come back with just thousands of much more data than the manned spacecraft could, the shuttles could. And it seemed like JPL was always fighting tooth and nail for funding for unmanned spacecrafts, and the space shuttle would get all the glory because they were a manned spacecraft, but they wouldn't bring back as much data as the unmanned spacecraft. And I believe Voyager is still sending back data from Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or to Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Yeah. Oh, very, very good observations and comments, John. I myself, that was one of the questions I would ask the presidential candidates. Are you in favor of space explorations through unmanned vehicles or through manned vehicles? This is not so much a scientific question. It's a political question. It's true what John says, that we can get a lot of data through the probes that we send. And it's also true we can learn about ourselves through manned space exploration. So this is an important question to look into. President Bush said that, you know, we will send a man or a woman to Mars to Mars sometime. That's a very costly undertaking. Should the federal government provide these kinds of funds to NASA to do the space explorations that way, or should they be provided to other agencies and other groups like the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and other groups? So that's a very important question. I myself, if you're asking me, John, I'm not running for president. I'm not eligible. I tend to favor the unmanned space explorations. But,
well, I'm prejudiced, too.
And you do, too, obviously. I mean, you work there. But there are people at NASA who share the position that we have here. Mm-hmm. And I think what's really important is for us to have an open discussion about this, to understand what the issues are and what the consequences of going one way or the other. And you know what? It may turn out going both ways.
Yeah. So, I'm not totally against the
demand.
Demand, but I would like to see more unmanned spacecraft go up.
Yeah.
And what are the benefits of the space station going to be? Does anybody even know what the benefits of that are going
to
be?
Well, we have to. We in the scientific community and we as citizens, we need to inform each other about this and try to make some intelligent choices. There are no simple choices that have to be made here, but we have to make some intelligent choices, and that's why I think issues like this are at the very heart of what should be going on in the presidential campaign. They're not the only issues that should be discussed in the presidential campaign, but they are really at the very heart of what happens in our country in the next 4 years, maybe 8 years, even longer. No matter who is the president,
mm-hmm.
no matter who is elected president, we need to address these issues because they have consequences militarily, economically, educationally, scientifically, technologically, environmentally, et cetera.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
I appreciate the call very much. Jeff in Phillips is next, so we'll go to you, Jeff. Hi.
Hello, Professor. This is a great show. Timely. There's nothing more important that you could be talking about. I really appreciate this. Too bad all the kids in school couldn't hear you talk. You know, if there's any move to get younger kids more interested in science, is that being talked about in the education program and, you know, younger grades? I also had a question. A medical doctor in our local paper in Ashland Daily Press was talking about how plastic water bottles have poisons in them that are bad for you and that you should use glass. I'll take my answer off there.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling. We've seen a little of that in the papers, and Newsweek magazine, I think, had something on that, too.
Thank you, Jeff, for all of your observations. Yes, it's important to get kids and the parents of kids and the friends of kids informed about this. By the way, if you have access to the web, you can listen to a rebroadcast of this program,
mm-hmm.
as well as any other program on Wisconsin Public Radio. And if you just go to the Wisconsin Public Radio website, you can listen to that. So maybe you'd like to do that. Now, as far as the
plastic water bottles?
Plastic water bottles. There's stuff in there. Again, you know, petrochemical products, and they're useful chemicals, but they also have potential hazards. So, bisphenol A, for example, which is the one that's been in the news lately, and I want to commend the Milwaukee paper for actually going out strongly and mentioning what the issues are. But I also want to call on my fellow scientists to try to address this issue informatively so that we really understand what gets leached out and what doesn't get leached out and what are the long-term ramifications of it. So baby bottles, for example, depending on where they're made, and some are made overseas, they should they be subjected to the same controls that we have for materials made in this country? I'd say yes. How do we check that something is not being leached out in the drinking in a plastic bottle that is to be used by us, or in the baby bottle that's to be used by the baby? So I think the recommendations that I know about, if you use a polycarbonate bottle, if you use one of those polycarbonate bottles, then the tendency to lose material from it through leaching is highly diminished. So one has to be, again, informed about this whole slew of plastics, Larry. They're just all over.
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Ed in Wausau, before we go to Ed, I just wanted to mention we've been talking about earlier, we talked about hydrogen fuel, and we're working on a show with a leading hydrogen researcher at Penn State University, just having some little issues getting his class schedule lined up with our program schedule, but we will be having a show on that. Jim Packer let me know that, reminded me of that. So we'll go to Ed next in Wausau. Ed, hello.
Hi, thank you for the program. When we're talking about some of the presidential candidates asking questions, and then what I've been watching, what the media does with those answers, you know, pounding them into the point of being ridiculous, I just wonder, you know, because we have both a Congress that determines things and a Supreme Court. How can you tactfully ask questions of a candidate? Like, even one of the candidates is a constitutional lawyer, and I'm sure his answer would probably not be understood by 90% of the audience. But just thought I'd mention.
Okay.
Very good point, Ed. I think the debate has to be informed and has to be understood by not only the candidates and their supporters, but by the rest of us. I mean, otherwise, what's the point of having it? I wasn't going to say this, Larry, but I've been disappointed in these debates. I've been disappointed in the statements that come from many of our elected officials, even after they're elected. They should show some respect to the intelligence of the American public and speak clearly and with conviction and with understanding about some of these issues. Some of the statements that are made politically and otherwise by many of our elected officials, make me think that they think we are dumb. So, Ed, you brought up a very good point, and the questions and the dialogue should not be lost in legal jargon. You're right. It should be plain talk, simple talk. And if there's an issue that we don't know the answer to, we should simply say we don't know the answer. No. I mean, that's what we do in science all the time. When we have more questions than we have answers.
Thanks for calling, Ed. And Bassam, thank you so much. And again, I want to remind everybody that you always put up information on your website, www.scifun.org, S-C-I-F-U-N. So go to his website. In a couple of days, you'll have the website, the links and so forth that we've been talking about. And it's also a fun place to look and see the experiments he's got that you can do with your children or your grandkids. A lot of great information on that website, scifun.org. Thanks, Bassam.
You're welcome.
Bassam Shakashiri is UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry and William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin Idea. Coming up, we're going to be visiting with UW System President Kevin Riley. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.